Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 1st, 2003. Today's session is entitled Healing Through Our Attitude, Session 1 of Healing of Our World, presented by John Leonard, number LEJ2003-01. Let's listen in.
The theme for my talks are Healing of Our World, the theme for the year here at Holden, and I've broken it down in different parts. Today I want to talk about healing our world through our attitude. And I really believe in the poem I'm going to read you. It's one that everyone in this room has heard by Emily Dickinson. And it seems to me that if I want to begin to heal our world, I begin with myself and the little things that I can do. If I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain. If I can ease one life the aching, or cool one pain, or help one fainting robin unto his nest again, I shall not live in vain. The Beatitudes I like to think of as be-attitude. This is the attitude to have. The word in Latin, beatus, means happy, and they all begin happy the person, happy the person, happy the person. But be attitude. These are attitudes to look at. And what I want to do is illustrate the Beatitudes through stories. But before I do that, I want to start with a song, and then I'm going to give you a questionnaire, because I know you love questionnaires.
You shall cross the barren desert, but you shall not die of thirst. You shall wander far in safety, though you do not know the way. You shall speak your words to foreign men, that I am with you.
Still needs a pen. Okay.
I'm gonna go out and get some.
You're gonna get some. This is mine.
That's yours.
This is mine, yeah. And I used to give this questionnaire. I taught religion for 36 years, and I've given this questionnaire to adults, to high school students, and to junior high kids, seventh graders. So what I'd like you to try and do is look at the Beatitude. I have kind of an explanation of question form on what it might mean. And then circle yourself from 1 to 5, 1 being the lowest, and 5 being the highest. And then, I think this is really important, if you can think of a person that you think lives out this beatitude, then put in the name. Do you know anyone who lives out, blessed are the poor in spirit? And when we finish this, then what I'm going to do is I'll talk about the Beatitudes, and I will talk probably more than I want to, and then we'll come back to the questionnaire at the end, if that's all right. I want to make sure I can get through all 8 Beatitudes. Is that okay? Okay. So if you have any questions, don't be afraid to ask me. I don't have any answers, but you can still ask me.
Thank you.
give you two more minutes, whether you're finished or not finished, okay? You can just take this with you. Is anyone finished? Very good. To do is talk about each of the Beatitudes, illustrate them with stories, because the way I've taught for 36 years is through telling stories. I'm a firm believer that story, which is the way Jesus taught, story is something that opens up our imagination and lets us go beyond a simple answer. So if you look at the parables of Jesus, the parables have not one meaning, you know, they're broad. They just open up and we can keep thinking and thinking and thinking about what the parables are about. So I'd like to start with the first beatitude. Blessed are the poor in spirit. This is the one I rank myself highest on. By far. Highest. Give myself a 4 or a 5. If I'm being honest, I probably give myself a 3. But 4 or 5. And why is this beatitude so important for me? It's by far the most important for me, and it has to do with my personal history. In 1990, I left Seattle, Washington, and went to Sundown, an alcoholic treatment center just north of Yakima, Washington. I'd been an alcoholic for I don't know how many years. And finally, I bombed out, and I made a phone call, and it got to my principal, and she said, go. So I decided that I would go down to Sundown, but I would bring my Bible, because I taught Scripture for years. And so I wanted to bring something that would speak to me, and something I could hear with sober ears. And the treatment was 3 weeks long. The book that I decided to read was 2 Isaiah, which is Isaiah 40 to 55, written when the Jews were in exile. 2 Isaiah begins, "Comfort, give comfort to my people. Tell them that their servitude is at an end." It is absolutely gorgeous. It also has the 4 servant songs in it. But whenever I'd come across the word service or servitude, I would substitute the word alcoholism. And I divided those chapters into parts where I would read a little bit every day over a period of 3 weeks. And nothing has spoken more to me than 2 Isaiah, "Comfort, give comfort, my servitude is at an end." When I came back from treatment and started rereading Scripture, having gone through it, I looked at the Beatitudes because I taught the Beatitudes. And I remembered an older version of the Bible. And actually, I looked it up in here, and it's the version you have in the library here. The New English Bible. The first Beatitude was translated, "Blessed are those who know their need of God." And boy, did that speak to me. I knew my need of God. Second step, you say, you acknowledge you're an alcoholic and you can't control it on your own. The third step is you seek a higher power and you turn it over to a higher power. You cannot conquer alcoholism on your own. In fact, you cannot conquer alcoholism. I am an alcoholic, even though I haven't had a drink in 13 years. I will always be an alcoholic. It's something in my system. So I turn over to God and realize that it is God that I need. That's why I put that number one for me. I need God in my life. And that beatitude really, really, really says something to me. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. I want to define the kingdom in terms that I haven't seen anybody else define it. The kingdom is participation in God's being. Participation in God's being. I open up to the need for God, and I let God and I become one insofar as I can. Let me tell you a story. One of my favorite stories. I probably say that about 9 out of 10 stories that I tell. But one of my very favorite stories. It's a story of a Jewish couple who really, really loved each other. And so they got married. And he did well in business. And she was great around the house and was a great cook. But like so many couples in Hebrew scripture, she couldn't have a child. And so every night before they'd go to bed, they would stand at the foot of their bed. They would raise their hands and they would say, "Master of the universe, Master of the universe, send us a son." And years went by and years went by and still no child appeared. Till finally the woman became pregnant. Woo! Boy, there was joy in that house. And if their love was great, their love was even greater now. And for 9 months, they just celebrated the fact that she was going to be a mother. He was going to be a father. And secretly, they prayed that it would be a boy. The time came for the baby to be born, and they delivered the baby, and the father was so happy because the baby had to be circumcised, so it was a boy. And they named him Mordecai. Now they started looking forward to something else, and that was to the day that they could send Mordecai off to synagogue, where he would study Torah, and he would come to know his God. So the years went by, and finally Mordecai was old enough to go to synagogue. And I'd ruin the story if I told you they took him to synagogue. No, they sent him to synagogue. And so they put the yarmulke on his head. And the mother said, "Mordecai, love of my life, precious being, go to synagogue. Come to know your God." And she sent him off. And Mordecai went running in the fields and climbing the trees and swimming in the streams. And he never made it to synagogue. Never. Came home that night, and Ruth was waiting at the door. And up Mordecai came, and she said, "Mordecai, love of my life, how was synagogue?" And Mordecai, having been taught to always tell the truth, said, "Mama, I did not go." And in her gentle, Jewish, motherly way, she said, "You didn't go to synagogue!" "No, Mama, I did not go to synagogue." "Tomorrow you go." Yarmulke on and sent him off the next day. Went running in the fields and climbing in the trees and swimming in the streams. And he never made it to synagogue. Oh, Ruth and her husband just sat down and said, "What can we do? What can we do to Mordecai? He's got to go to synagogue. He's got to study Torah. He has to come to know his God." Husband said, "Let's bring in a behavior modifier." So they brought in a behavior modifier. And when the behavior modifier had modified the behavior of Mordecai, he said, "Send him to synagogue and he will go." So the next day, with the yarmulke on his head, they sent him to the synagogue. And he went running in the fields and climbing the trees and swimming in the streams and never made it. What do you do when these things happen? Of course, you could say you could tape them yourself, but no, that ruins the story. So then, what can we do? What can we do? A child psychologist. That will do. So they brought Mordecai to a child psychologist, and the child psychologist unplugged the plugs that were plugging Mordecai, and he said, you will go to synagogue tomorrow. So they sent him to synagogue with his yarmulke on, and he went running in the fields and climbing the streams and swimming in the streams and never made it. Well, now what do you do? This is getting awfully, awfully hard. Then they heard that there was a holy, holy rabbi who was visiting their neighborhood. So they went down to the rabbi and they said, our son, we sent him to synagogue and he doesn't go. And we want him to study Torah and come to know his God. What can we do? And the rabbi said, bring the boy to me. So the next day, they brought Mordecai down to the synagogue to the visiting rabbi, and they brought him in to where the rabbi was, and the rabbi said to the husband and wife, leave. They left. Mordecai looked at the rabbi. He was about 6 feet 5 inches tall, and he had a beard about 4 feet long. He looked like a big oak tree with moss coming down. Mordecai was scared to death of this huge thing. And the rabbi didn't really say anything. He reached down. Mordecai was trembling. He picked up Mordecai. He held him out in his hands like this. And then he brought him to his heart. And he hugged him. And he hugged him. And he hugged him. And then he put Mordecai down and he said, tomorrow, go to synagogue. And Mordecai left. The next day, they get the yarmulke on. They say, okay, Mordecai, it's time to go to synagogue. Mordecai said, okay. And he left. And he went all the way to synagogue. And that day he studied an itsy bitsy teeny weeny little bit of Torah. But some Torah. And when he was finished with the lesson with the other children, the rabbi said, now go home. And he started home and he went running in the fields. And he found God in the fields. And he went climbing the trees. And he found God in the trees. And he went swimming in the stream. And he found God in the stream. I love that story. We each need a rabbi in our lives. A loved one, a friend, maybe a pastor. Someone who will embrace us, either physically or emotionally, and let us open our eyes so that, like Mordecai, we can see God in our lives and in our world. And in seeing God and in being part of that, we're getting to be part of God's kingdom. Second, the attitude. Blessed are those who mourn. Just a couple of words here on mourning. My question would be, what moves you from sympathy to empathy? What moves you from sympathy to empathy? I talked with a lady who was a good friend. Her name was Christy. Christy was the art teacher. And one day Christy came to me and said, John, I have a problem. My teenager, who's 17, is an alcoholic. And I don't know what to do. So Lila and I invited Christy over for dinner and we talked about what to do, and I suggested Sundown because I thought Sundown was a great place to go if you had an addiction problem. But he's 17 now, remember. I was in my I don't know what I was in 10 years ago. I was in my 40s. No, 50s. I'm trying to become young again. And so she sent him to synagogue. She sent him to sundown. I got the last story in my mind. He went, he came back, he was good for a while, then he went off the deep end again. And then the next time we talked to her, he'd really been binging, and he was in a car going down the freeway up by Bellingham. Her husband lived in Bellingham. She lived in Seattle, her ex-husband. And while the car was going down the freeway, he opened up the door and went out. They brought him to the emergency room. The doctor said he's not going to survive. He did survive. Gradually. And then he came over to her house later on, once he was better, and when she was gone, he brought in some beer and drank beer and totally made a house disaster. And she searched and she searched and she tried to find a place for somebody young to go and get help. Now, when she talked to Lila and me about the time, about this when we were together, we certainly moved from sympathy to empathy. I really, really felt with Christy. But if you think this problem with alcoholism is bad, then the other day, about a month ago, I guess, I'm at church and I hear from somebody that Christy's daughter, who is 23 and married, has terminal cancer. So here's this woman with two children. One who's still alcoholic, I mean, will always be alcoholic, but hasn't, is still going back and drinking again. And this 23-year-old who's married, who's given maybe 6 months to live. And I went and saw her, and all I could do was hold her. As you know, when you see people like this and you don't know what to say, all you can do is hold them. Move from sympathy to empathy. And I keep asking myself, this has had nothing to do with blessed are those who mourn, but keep asking myself, why is it that some people seem to have this happen more often than other people? And I certainly hold Christy in my prayers every single day, and her daughter and her son. When I think of blessed are those who mourn, I think of a true story of Sister Rose, who worked in a homeless shelter for teenagers. And one day this young gal came in her teens, and she had a paint can and then a few little things that she had to dress with and so forth. And they put her up. And Sister Rose noticed that Kathy, this young gal, that wherever she went, she took the paint can. Everywhere. She'd go to supper, the paint can would be on the table right next to her. So Sister Rose decided, what am I going to do to find out, you know, something's strange about this girl, that she's got this paint can everywhere she went. So she said, Kathy, why not tomorrow morning, let you and I have breakfast by ourselves at the far end, a little before the rest, and I'll get some special food. So they got the special food, and they went down to the far end of the dining hall, Kathy with her paint can, and Sister Rose. And so they started talking, and then Sister Rose says, Kathy, can I ask you a question? Sure, sister, you can ask me anything you want. What's in the paint can? My mother. And then Sister just sort of looked at her, I'm almost going to cry when I say this, and said, your mother? And Kathy said, yes, my mother. When I was 3 days old, my mother abandoned me. Just left me, and someone picked me up. And all my life, I've been going from foster home to foster home to foster home to foster home. But as I got older, I decided, I'm going to find my mother. And I looked, and I looked, and I looked, and I looked, and finally, I found her name. I found out where she was. She was in the hospital. So I went to the hospital, and I walked into her room, and she was dozing, and there was a nurse there, and I said to the nurse, "This is my mother. What's wrong with her?" And the nurse said, "She has AIDS." So then the mother woke up and Kathy said, I'm your daughter. Remember so many years ago when you had a girl and you left her? I'm that one. I'm Kathy." And the mother nodded. They visited for a little while. And then the mother went back to sleep and Kathy left. Kathy came back the next day and walked in, and the mother opened her eyes and she said, "Kathy, I'm so sorry for what I did." And then she closed her eyes and died. The hospital people had the remains cremated, gave the ashes to Kathy, and she carried them around in this paint can wherever she went. It was her contact with her mother. When Sister Rose heard this story, she said, "Oh, Kathy, Kathy, can I have a hug?" "Of course, Sister." So they stood up and Sister Rose put her arms around Kathy and pulled her to herself. But she couldn't get her too close because there was a paint can in between. Blessed are the meek. Jesus says, "I am meek and humble of heart." And he says this right after he says, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy burdened." To be meek is to be approachable. Jesus teaches us what it is to be meek by how he acts. I have two stories about meekness that say something to me. I hope they say something to you. The first is about Cezanne, the painter. Before he was discovered, there was someone who thought his stuff was pretty good, and so he gathered some of Cezanne's works together and put on an art display. And Cezanne brought his son to the art display. And they walked into the room where the art was, and Cezanne couldn't believe it. He looked around the room with all his paintings, and he turned to his son and he says, "Look, they framed my paintings." How simple he could be. There's also the story told of a man who was very, very holy, and God told the angels, "I want you to go down to this man, and I want you to give him whatever he wants. Give him whatever he wants." So the angels approached the man and they found him and they said, "God sent us down and he wants us to give you whatever you ask for. How about the gift of healing?" "No, I don't want the gift of healing. That's God's work." "Oh. Well, what about the gift of converting people?" "No, I don't want the gift of converting people. That belongs to angels." You gotta ask for something. You gotta ask for something. What are you gonna ask for? The man thought and he thought and he thought and he thought. Here's what I ask for. I ask that I always do good, but I do not know the good I do. And the angel said, "So be it." And so it happened that when the sun was shining and the shadow of the man was behind him, if the shadow fell upon a person who was sick or disturbed, the person was healed, either mentally or physically. If the shadow fell upon ground, the ground became fertile and things began to grow. So the man continued to do good, but he never saw the results of the good he did. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, Who are the righteous? They're the ones who bear fruit because they were planted by the Son of Man. The righteous are those who hear God's word and follow it. They adhere to the will of God. John Forrest, in his book, The Ladder of the Beatitudes, says, "The righteous person is someone in whom others, especially those in need, experience the mercy of God." What always gets me about this beatitude is hunger and thirst. Do we hunger and thirst for righteousness? One day a disciple went to his master and he says, "Master, I want to know God. How do I come to know God?" And the master said, "Through desire." And the disciple said, "But I desire to know God." "Okay," the master said. That was it. The next day, the two of them were bathing in the river, side by side. The master turned to the disciple, took his head and pushed it underneath the water, and kept it underneath the water, and kept it underneath the water, until there was a struggle and struggle and struggle, and finally he let him up. And the disciple went, And the master said, "How come you were struggling?" And the disciple said, "Because I didn't have any air." And the master said, "When you desire God as much as you desired air, then you shall find God." Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the merciful. Mercy makes us look out. I have a favorite quote. My very favorite quote of all quotes. I wrote it. And the quote goes like this. I'm not certain what my Pope would think about this, but that's all right. "God is not just, she is merciful." And that is the quote that sustains me. I believe in a merciful God. A merciful God. If you look at the last judgment in Matthew's Gospel, where you find the Beatitudes that I'm talking about, you know, how are we judged? By how we treat our neighbor. By how merciful we are. There's a story of a man whose lawn needed mowing, and so he decided, "I don't want to mow it. I'll have my daughter mow it." So he called his daughter in, and he said to her, "Honey, I'll give you $10 to mow the lawn. Will you do it?" "Sure," she said. So he went back, and he was busy reading the newspaper, and she was out mowing the lawn. It went on for a while, and she came in, and he said, "Are you done all right already?" She said, "Yes, I am." So he said, "Well, let me take a look." So he went outside, and he looked all around, and the lawn was absolutely beautiful, except there was one section that she skipped. And he said to her, "Honey, you haven't finished mowing the lawn. You got to do that section over there." "No." "Well, then you're not going to get your $10. "Fine." And she left. Well, he couldn't figure this out. She needed money, and $10 was $10 after all. So he thought, why didn't she mow that section of the lawn? So he walked down to that section of the lawn and looked, and here was a frog with some baby frogs all cuddled up in that grass. He went back in the house. He called his daughter to him and said, "Here," and he handed her a $20 bill. Not only had she mowed the lawn, but she had shown mercy. There's another story, one of my favorites. Oh, it's only the second time I've said that. Another one that's one of my favorites, and it's about a holy man and a village and a star. There was a small village at the foot of a tall, tall mountain. And in the small village, there was a holy man, and he did his work quietly. He wasn't ostentatious about what he did. But the people knew that he did not eat nor drink from sunrise to sunset. And this was between him and God, but people saw that he was different from the rest of him. Well, one day it happened that they looked up in the sky, and above the mountain there was a new star. And all the people in the village said, "The star belongs to the holy man. God put it there because we have a holy man in our midst." Everybody said that. And the holy man heard this, and he thought, "You know, maybe I should climb the mountain to get a better view of that star. I don't know if it's mine or not mine, but I'd like to see that star more close up." So he told the people he would be away for a while because he was going to climb the mountain to look at the star. And this little girl came up to him. "Can I come with you? Can I come with you?" He says, "Sure, you can come with me. We'll leave tomorrow morning." So the next morning he left with the little girl. And they climbed and they climbed and they climbed and they climbed, and they came to a place where there was a spring. And the holy man said to the little girl, "Honey, go there and put your hands underneath the spring and drink and drink and drink, because if you don't drink, you're going to get sick." And she said, "I won't drink unless you drink." And the holy man remembered his vow, "I don't eat or drink from sunrise to sunset." He says, "Honey, I don't need to drink. I'm older and I don't need as much liquid as you do. I won't drink unless you drink." Well, this conversation, as it was, went back and forth, "I won't drink unless you drink." And the guy thought, "What am I going to do? Do I break my vow and drink? Or do I not break my vow and the poor little girl's going to collapse and be very, 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 very sick?" So finally he said, "Okay." And he went over to this spring and he put his hands underneath and he got some water and he drank one handful of water. "Your turn, honey." And she drank and she drank and she drank and she drank and she drank. And he said, "Okay, now it's time to continue up the mountain, see what we can see." So they started up the mountain. Had a ways to go before the sun would go down and they'd be able to see the star. But the holy man walked like this. Even when it started to become dark, he walked like this because he had broken his vow. And he was certain that if the star was his star because of his good acts, the star would have disappeared. So walk, walk, walk with the little girl. And they get up to the very top and he thinks, "Well, I gotta look. I can't just stand like this old." So he looked up to see if the star was still there. And he saw in the sky two stars instead of one. Blessed are the pure in heart. All I'm going to do here is tell a story. It's a true story. It's a story about a woman named Ruth who lived 4 miles from the ocean in the state of Washington. And she would drive out to the ocean whenever she was down, and she would walk on the beach. Walk on the beach. I'm certain some of you like that kind of experience. There's something about the ocean that to me is healing, especially being from Spokane originally and not ever seeing the ocean. So she went out there this one time and there was this little girl sitting in the sand, playing in the sand, and the little girl looked at her and says, "Hi, I'm Wendy. I'm 6 years old. What's your name?" And she said, "Oh, you can call me Mrs. P." "Good, good. How are you, Mrs. P?" "Oh, I just need to be alone," Mrs. P said. "Okay. Oh, look, there's a sandpiper. Mama says that sandpipers are given to us to bring us joy. Okay, thank you. Bye, Wendy. And Ruth went walking. Next time she went out to the ocean, she looked and there was Wendy. Again, Ruth was down. Ruth said to Wendy, "Wendy, where do you live?" And Ruth pointed to a vacation home on the beach. And Ruth said to her, "Shouldn't you be in school?" And Wendy said, "Mama said that we're extending our vacation this year, so we're going to stay here longer." "Oh, okay. Thank you." And Ruth went off. And she realized after she left, Ruth, that every time she saw Wendy, the two times, that Wendy did something to her, made her feel better. Well, then one time, Ruth's mother died, and Ruth went to the ocean to mourn her mother, and there was Wendy. And Wendy started talking, and Ruth said, "Honey, I just can't talk now, my mother died." And Wendy said, "Was it painful?" And Ruth said, "Yes, it was painful. I feel so bad. I'm so sorry," Wendy said, and Ruth went walking. Months went by. Ruth went back out to the ocean on another down day. No Wendy. She went over to the cabin and she knocked on the door. And a mother came out. And she said, "Is Wendy here?" Ruth did. And the woman said, "No. We were taking extra time off because Wendy was dying of leukemia, and she died." And Ruth says, "Oh my gosh, I am so sorry. I didn't even know. I didn't even guess." And the mother said, "Are you Mrs. P?" And she said, "Yes, I'm Mrs. P." The mother said, "Wendy left something for you." So in she went, came back out, and when she came out, she had a painting of a sandpiper with the words, "A sandpiper to bring you joy." And the mother and the daughter wept and wept and wept. And if you'll let me find a page here, I want to read a quote from what Ruth had to say. It's right here. Ruth concludes her story. "The precious little picture is framed now and hangs in my study. 6 words, one for each year of her life. They speak to me of inner harmony, courage, and undemanding love. A gift from a child with sea blue eyes and hair the color of sand, who taught me the gift of love." Blessed are the peacemakers. This is why I'm wearing this shirt. It says down here someplace, "Blessed are the peacemakers." Then it says Guadalupe House, which probably doesn't have much meaning for most of you. Guadalupe House is a house in Tacoma. The picture of Jesus is really a takeoff on Our Lady of Guadalupe, the Mexican painting of the Blessed Virgin. And Guadalupe House is a Catholic worker house in Tacoma. Catholic Workers, a group founded by one of my favorite people, Dorothy Day. And I love this thing because it has peacemakers, and then it has 4 people, I think, besides Jesus. Martin Luther King, Desmond Tutu, Mahatma Gandhi, and we think this is probably Mother Teresa. 4 people whom I would call peacemakers. I always remember, when I think of peacemakers, the movie Gandhi. And if you remember, Gandhi lived at a time when the Hindus and the Muslims were clashing, and we get the formation of Pakistan and India. And the Muslims are going north, and whatever Hindus are north are coming south. And Gandhi is fasting, sitting on the top of his house. And as he's sitting there, this Hindu comes up to him and he says, "Master, Master." He says, "Yes, my son." He says, "We ran into Muslims and on our way south, and I killed one of them. What should I do?" And Gandhi said to him, "Here is what I want you to do. Find an orphan, preferably from a Muslim family. Adopt him and raise him as a Muslim." There's this African story about a Somali woman that I think is very pertinent to how we work for peace. Somali woman was in the northern part, the high part of Somalia, and a man came up and asked her to marry her and marry him, and she said, "I'd love to," and so they got married, and then they went back to his village, and she got to meet his son. His former wife had died. Son that was fairly small. And so this woman tried to win over the son. She would cook special meals, and the son would push the food to the side. And she would make special clothes, and the son wouldn't wear anything that she made. And finally she said to him, "How come when I try and give you good food and I try and give you clothes, you don't accept them? You're not my mother." "But your mother's dead." "You're not my mother." So the holy woman decided, or the Somali woman decided, "What can I do?" And she decided to go to the village holy man. And she said, "Can you make me a potion that I can give to this son of mine that I can win him over?" And the medicine man says, "Yes, I can do that. You have to bring me some whiskers from a lion." She said, "Whiskers from a lion? Yes. How do I get them?" "I don't know." So she thought, "How am I going to get whiskers from a lion?" So she knew where the lion lived, up by a cave. And so she got some raw meat, and she went as far away as she could with still seeing the lion. And she put the meat out, and then she ran away and hid. And the lion came out and ate the meat. Over a period of 3 months, each day she would get a little closer, a little closer, a little closer. So finally, at the end of the 3 months, she took the food right in front of the cave and put it down. The lion was used to her by this time. After all, this is his meal ticket. The lion comes out and starts to eat the meat. And she clips off some of the whiskers and runs like mad. So she gets back to the holy man, the medicine man, and she says to the holy man, "Here, I got the whiskers. Now, can you make me the potion?" And the holy man says to her, "I don't know how to make a potion that will win your son over." "What?" "I don't know how to make a potion, but I do know this much. Approach the son the way you approached the lion, and then you will win him over." And she did, and they became best friends. And finally, blessed are those who suffer persecution. This is the one I score myself lowest on. I suspect most of us are not real big into being persecuted. Not at all. I haven't been persecuted in my life, but one of the times that I considered myself close to persecution was I was a Jesuit for 17 years, and I worked in Africa for 6 of those years, 2 different times. And during my second tour in Africa, I was teaching theology in a major seminary for Zambia and Malawi. And I decided I wanted to leave and get married. And so I told the provincial lad that I was going to come home and do my paperwork at home. But at that point, the Catholic Church said that anyone who is an ex-priest is not allowed to teach religion. Now here I had been teaching religion all my life up to that time and was teaching in a major seminary. And I thought, oh my. And then I thought, if I let this bug me, if I get angry at the church, I'm the one who's going to be destroyed, and I'm not going to have any effect upon the church. None whatsoever. They'll just ignore me. So I decided I'm not going to get angry. I'm not going to get angry. I'm going to, you know, push it out of my mind whenever I start getting those feelings. It was ironic when I came back and left the Jesuits. I went down and I visited some Jesuits at Bellarmine High in Tacoma. And there was an ex-Jesuit there who was in my class. And they said, oh, there's a job opening at Forest Ridge in Bellevue, which is an all-girls Catholic school. So Jesuits and ex-Jesuits got me a job teaching at a Catholic school, and I've been teaching religion ever since. And somehow the schools I taught in ignored the thing from Rome. To which I say, amen. One last story. I don't mean to talk this much. Well, the next time we meet, we'll have more time, because I want to hear what you, if you come back to the next session, which you may not do after today, but if you do come back to the next session, I'd like to begin it with your how you graded yourself, and if you know people who live out the Beatitudes. Suffer persecution for justice sake. There's a story told about a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. And how he got it, I'm not certain, but there was this prisoner who had a guitar. And he would be in the courtyard when they had free time, and he would be playing the guitar and singing, and all the prisoners were happy. So the guards decided, we don't want happy prisoners, they're supposed to be sad. This is a prison after all. So they went up and they said, don't play the guitar. So the next day, they were up in their guard planes, and they looked down, and here's the guy out there playing the guitar, and all the people happy again. They went down, and they chopped the guy's fingers off. That'll do it, they said. Next day, they're up in the guard tower looking down. Here's the guy out there strumming the guitar with the stumps of his finger, not sounding too good, and all the people are listening. We told you not to play the guitar, they said. They go down, and they smash the guitar. Next day, they're in their tower looking down on the prisoners. The guy is out there, stumps his hands here, singing away, rocking back and forth. Ah! And all the people are rocking with him. The guards come down, and they cut out his tongue. Next day, they look down in the courtyard. And here's the man who cannot play the guitar and cannot sing, rocking back and forth to an unheard melody. And everybody was rocking with him. And the guards did nothing. Our time is up. I hope at least one story said something to you. And I hope the Beatitudes mean something. And if you come next time, which is at 10:45 tomorrow, bring your Beatitude thing, and we'll start off by going over those, and then tomorrow we'll talk about salt and light, and we might hear a few more stories. Thank you very much.